Welcome to Thinking Ahead. I'm your host, Carter Phipps, and we're exploring the movements, trends, people, and ideas that are shaping our evolving world. Make sure you subscribe today on your favorite podcast platform, and most of all, I hope you enjoy today's episode. In the 2019 book, American Cosmic, scholar Diana Pasulka suggested that UFOs and the obsession with them had become a type of post-secular religion. But a strange thing happened as she studied more and more about the subject. She went from being somewhat skeptical to curious to more and more convinced that there's a real phenomenon happening here. And she was helped along the way on that journey, as the book describes, by two individuals who are under pseudonyms in the book, who are part of what is sometimes called the Invisible College, meaning scientists and academics and researchers who study the UFO phenomenon but don't talk publicly about it. Now, one of those individuals, celebrated Stanford professor Gary Nolan, has since become a lot more public, and UFOs have become a lot more public as well. They've gone from an underground countercultural subject to something more approaching mainstream recognition and interest. Even Congress is getting involved with the recent hearings on the subject. Now, on this podcast, last year, I featured Australian journalist Ross Coulthart. That was my one other episode about UFOs. And he spoke about the government's involvement with the subject. And I definitely recommend, if you haven't heard that podcast, it's fantastic. Go back and listen to it. But in this episode of Thinking Ahead, I was interested in having on Pasulka to talk about her book and her forays into this area of study. And in particular, her unique religious background makes her more able to address some of the stranger aspects of this phenomenon that go beyond the nuts and bolts part of UFO research, what people call the nuts and bolts, meaning the sightings of physical aircrafts. There's also a dimension of this that interfaces with some of the deeper aspects of human experience, I guess, like consciousness and even spiritual or ontological matters in ways that are interesting, surprising, and sometimes just very strange. So I've wanted to speak to Dr. Pasulka for a long time, and I'm thrilled to finally have her on the podcast. Let's welcome author and academic Diana Pasulka to Thinking Ahead. All right. Diana, welcome to the podcast. I appreciate you coming on today.
Thank you so much. I'm happy to be here.
So it's great to talk to you. I've read your book, American Cosmic, which came out now, I don't know, like 4 years ago, something like
2019.
That?
2019.
Almost five? Oh, so it's not quite. So 3 years ago. Okay. And we almost met a number of years ago when we were both sort of attending a conference at Esalen, which I think in the end you couldn't attend at the last minute, so we didn't get a chance to meet. So it's great to meet virtually today and to talk about a subject that I'm super interested in, that you've written a book about and have done research on. So before we get into some of the dimensions of this I want to talk about, my first thought was just to bring the listeners up to speed, to get a little sense of like how you got into the subject of UFOs from a religious scholar's perspective. Mm-hmm. And how you got into that subject, how you came to write the book, what the book is about, and then I'd love to hear about, you know, where you've come since the book was published as well. But let's start with that.
Yeah, so that's the best place to start, because it seems very incongruous to have someone who's a scholar of religion talking about UFOs, and a lot of people are like, "What?" And it happened pretty organically. First, everyone should know that I came to the topic a complete atheist with respect to UFOs, bordering on that kind of person who disbelieves and even almost scoffs. Okay. So I was a person who, if somebody said, yeah,
you're one of those.
Yes, I was one of those. I can't believe it now, but it's true. And so I've spent my life and career studying miraculous events in the Catholic tradition. Okay. A lot of that focuses on archival reports of saints levitating and things like that. So I actually do work mm-hmm. with the Vatican. I have a contract with the Vatican where I'm digitizing and translating. I head the project of translation of a saint called Joseph of Copertino, who is this Italian saint who is the flying saint. He said to be the flying saint. Okay. So, yeah. So I have his canonization records. I got those from the Vatican. And
interesting.
So, you know, that's what I've been focusing on. I teach. I'm at the University of North Carolina.
And you have a background in Catholic. Did you grow up Catholic? Is that your
background? Okay, so that's a good question. I'm from California. And, you know, in California.
Where in California?
Northern California, near Sacramento. I mean, actually, I was born in Los Angeles. My family moved to San Francisco, where my grandparents have lived and owned, you know, these pharmaceutical stores, basically Rexall drug stores. And so, so I grew up partially in San Francisco, and then we moved to this place right below Auburn, and it's called Folsom Lake, this area, Granite Bay, Folsom Lake. And in this area, it's a very eclectic in terms of people's religions. I would call it, there's a general aura of New Age practice. It doesn't matter what religion you're a part of. You could be a Baptist.
California.
And you're going to know what vibe means, right? You're going to know the language of the New Age culture.
Yeah.
All right.
So, I lived in Northern California for half my adult life, so I know it well.
That's right. Yeah. So you're aware of this lingo and the lexicon, right? The Northern California lexicon. Okay. So I grew up with one parent who was Jewish, from a Jewish, you know, my mother's Jewish, but secular Jewish, but still does practices, right? And so my father, who was somewhat Catholic, I would have to say, you know, Irish Catholic, brought up Irish Catholic. And so, but they were mostly New Age. So they mostly had, you know, they had a library of books from philosophy, Greek philosophy, all the way up through Gurdjieff and stuff like that. So I was really exposed to all this as a child. And what happened to me was that I went to a Catholic school where it was run by sisters, and I was exposed to people who were what I would call holy people. Okay. This was during the time period when all the disappeared people were happening in El Salvador and liberation theology.
Yeah, sure.
So these women were liberation theologians, basically.
Oh, wow.
And they were walking the talk, right? So they were,
serious.
And this made a huge impression on 16-year-old
Romero. And that
exactly. And some of the people that I'm still friends with, like sisters from that time period, you know, their colleagues were martyred down there, you know, the Jesuits and Ursuline nuns and stuff.
Oh,
so,
yeah.
You know, this made a huge impression on me against the backdrop of what I would call consumer New Ageism, you know, where you had a lot of people who were super wealthy, you know, practicing yoga and, you know, taking from Asian religions and changing them, really. But I mean, what was I going to choose as a kid who was inclined to try to do the right thing, right? I was going to choose Catholic, you know, my Catholic tradition. So, so that's what I did. And, So that's kind of how I got into religious studies. So I decided I wanted to study about this because it looked like this is what we need. We needed this kind of thing in our lives, you know, this kind of like doing actually good work for other people. And I went to school and I got into doing, you know, Catholic history. You have to specialize in when you get a PhD in religious studies. I was always interested in philosophy, though. So, all right. So I get a PhD and I come to North Carolina, where there's the only job opening for a person who has my skill set. And it's a beautiful place.
You could do a lot worse.
I know. It's like, you know, it's kind of like Santa Cruz on the East Coast.
Wilmington rides.
Yeah.
I mean, boy,
it's really nice.
That's awesome.
So I got this job I didn't even have my PhD yet, but I was lucky and I got this job. And I still feel so lucky to be here. So I spent my time basically publishing and earning tenure. And I published about things like Catholic doctrine of purgatory and saints, you know, who have these miraculous, you know, things happen to them. And I did a lot of this work, and it was mostly archival work where you're in archives and you're looking at books from 1600, 1700, 1800s. And, you know, a lot of them in different languages, like either French or Italian or something like that. And so, you know, pretty scholarly, nothing that the general populace, I think, would be interested in unless they were interested in that, you know, which actually sure, I yeah. find it interesting, you know. So, yeah. So I published and, you know, did well, I guess. Well, this is what happened. During that time period of getting the information and the anecdotes and reports, I was coming upon a lot of reports of aerial phenomena in European Catholicism and Canadian Catholicism, North American Catholicism. And there were so many, and they occurred, the patterns were similar, and they occurred in such diverse areas over a long, you know, 1,000 years, basically. Mm-hmm. So I kept this log, but I didn't really know what to think about that because UFOs were the furthest thing from my mind. Didn't think about those at all. So I had this log of strange aerial phenomena. Mostly the people who experienced these things would interpret them as either angels or souls from purgatory. Sometimes they'd interpret them as demons, you know, things like that. Yeah. Like a religious overlay, right?
Sure. I get the angels and demons. The souls from purgatory was new in your book. I didn't know that was part of the interpretive structure.
It was. It was most, in fact, it was mostly souls from purgatory.
That's interesting.
And if you look at a lot of the images of how they represented the souls from purgatory, in fact, I have a Twitter account and I post those images sometimes where you can't tell the difference. You know, the modern meme of the UFO and people kind of going up into like
the light coming down and they levitate up.
Literally, that is what it looks like. The souls from purgatory. Wow. Yes, literally that you can't tell the difference. So anyway, I hadn't made that connection yet. I had all this. I had published a book and I had my next project, right? I was moving on to my next project, but I had this log of strange reports. So I showed it to a friend of mine and, you know, I wanted to get his perspective, you know, what are these things? Like, what do you make out of this? And he took a long time to look it over. And then finally his assessment was, this looks like Steven Spielberg stuff. And I was like, what? Steven Spielberg? He said, it looks like UFO contact events. And I thought he was crazy. So I was a little bit perturbed at the time. I was like, you spent all that time looking through this.
And
this
is what you have.
Yeah. And he said, no, I'm not kidding. And so it was, of course, and this is what happens in this type of research. Strange coincidences happen. So there was a UFO conference in Wilmington, and it was that weekend. And so I thought, you know, I'll just go to this conference and see what's going on. So I did. I went to the conference and I listened to these people who had these experiences, and it sounded exactly like what was in my log. So I recognized, I mean, really, I have to tell you that Sigmund Freud wrote this article in the early 20th century called The Uncanny. And it's really about this idea that stuff that you thought was imaginary is actually real. And I really had this sense of the uncanny. I was like,
at that moment, it must have been just like, what is happening?
That's exactly it. I was like, oh my goodness, it was horrifying almost, you know? And I was like, I just felt almost dread, you know, that I had been studying something that was still going on and people were talking about it in a different way. They're calling these things UFOs or aerial phenomena.
It was such a unique angle to come into this from. Yeah.
Totally unexpected, you know? And it was frightening. All kinds of things happened. So then I decided that, okay, I'll do that. I'll look at these things as a new form of religiosity, basically, you know. And I was also looking at technology because, you know, I went to grad school during the Silicon.com boom era. So everything to me seemed like Marshall McLuhan, you know, like Marshall McLuhan's like, you know, way of looking at technology was foremost in my mind. So that was another way to look at this new form of being religious, right? That it was a techno.
The medium is the message.
Yeah, exactly. Right? It's techno religion here. So, but things got a lot stranger after that.
Did you know, so we, our mutual friend who hosted those conferences that we missed at, was Jeff Kripal. Did you know Jeff? And Jeff is also a professor of religious studies at Rice. Did you know him at this point, or is that come later?
I did, actually. So this is so strange. Another weird thing that happened was that Jeff Kripal was a good friend of Cynthia Reed, who was my editor at Oxford. And she suggested that he blurb my book about purgatory because, you know, I don't know if you know this, but he was actually in training to be a monk. So he was intrigued.
I think did know that at some point. Yeah, right.
So he has a huge knowledge of Catholic history.
Yeah, and right. Interesting.
Yeah. So he, and my book on purgatory, it was just a good setup, right? So, and plus I knew about him through Colley's Childs, because when I was in grad school, that was a huge book. And
oh, wow. Yeah. So you knew from there.
Yeah. Wow, and then what happened to him too after that, you know, was just amazing for my field. He was really well known in my field. So I felt honored that he would, you know, read my book and blurb it. And then we had a conversation, and it turned out that we knew similar people who were associated with UFOs. And then he was having this conference at, you know, it's Esalen, and he just said, you should come to this conference. And I was like, I guess so. So that's how it happened. So I went to this conference, and then we found out that I was doing an exegesis, basically a look into Teresa of Avila, if anybody's aware of her statue, Bernini's statue of her in Rome.
And, sure, yeah.
Yeah, so she's, you know, she's
being pierced by
this little cherub kind of angel thing, right? Well, that's not at all what it looks like if you read her account of it.
Right. I think I've read it, but you know, it was a long time ago.
So one of the first things that I did was I reread a lot of the things that I was already familiar with, and Jeff was too, because he wrote his master's thesis on her at University of Chicago. I think it was him. And he basically gave it a Freudian overlay, right? And so I said, no, this thing is real. And you know, she says this is not an imagined angel, this is actually a real thing, and I'm not even sure it's an angel. You know, she said it was all on fire, and it had this dart with a fire on the end of it, and it pierced her. You know, it was like from John Mack's abduction book. You know, it could have been a chapter.
Exactly. You see stories like that. I know people had experiences like that.
Yes.
Exactly. That's
so
very interesting.
I sent it to him. And I think that was the first time that he actually had this uncanny experience too, because, you know, he knows that text really well. He had a picture of her being pierced in his office. And, you know, we were like, we both had the uncanny experience at the very same time. So I think it created a bond.
Yeah, that's cool. That's nice. Interesting.
So I think that explains how I got into this study.
Yeah, that's great. And so then tell me a little bit about the book. So the book is called American Cosmic. It came out 3 years ago. How did you, you know, there's two main characters in the book that you kept their identity hidden in the book. They both have become public since then, right? So their identities are no longer hidden. Oh, is that true? I thought both were.
Okay. I think that both are known, but only one has said, this is me. And that's Dr. Gary Nolan. Yeah.
Right. And so I saw Gary Nolan present at one of those conferences, and he has since become a very public figure in this.
He's like a rock star.
He's a Stanford professor, rock star, UFO guy. He's everywhere now. Yeah. He just did a big thing on Tucker Carlson, did the hour interview with him on national television, and you know, all kinds of stuff. So he's become quite a figure.
Yeah.
But at the time he wasn't known at all. He wasn't known. But anyway, so those two are main figure characters in your book, and you explore this whole phenomenon as a kind of, as a new religion, as a new interpretive structure for a religious experience and a new way of thinking. So tell me about the book a little bit and how it came out and how it was received. And then I want to ask you sort of what's happened since then, but let's start with that.
Yeah, sure. Okay, so once I decided I was going to look into UFOs as this, not just a new religion, because there are UFO religions, right? Nation of Islam,
right, that's true.
You know, new UFO religion. I mean,
I did not, you know, I learned that at, I think some that conference, I think someone did a presentation. I did not know that the Nation of Islam was based on
a UFO.
That was fascinating.
I know.
That was
most
very
people
interesting.
Don't know that. Yeah. So, you know, there are many religions that are UFO religions, but I'm not saying that. I'm saying that there's a new form of religion that's happening. And it's happening, it's like a post-secular religion, because people now who can even consider themselves atheists can ascribe to this religiosity of the UFO, because first off, you have the government supporting belief now, right? Mm-hmm. And that, you know, I mean, when has that happened? Well, it's happened with most of the major religions, but back in the day, you know, back in like the 1200s or 4th century or something like that, you know, it's never been something that's happened within this, you know, 1750 onward from the Enlightenment. And so, you know, this is a new thing. And that's what I was trying to show. I also wanted people to understand how technology works on them cognitively, that, you know, when you see images of UFOs and everything, you're already primed to see aerial phenomena in those images, in those ways. I also wanted to share with them that what we're told and what we see has been heavily redacted, because in 1947, that's kind of the point that a lot of scholars say is the beginning of the UFO flying saucer. It's not, but that's what has commonly been.
The modern version of it sort of begins with Roswell in 47 and that, right, exactly.
Well, the reason it does is because that's when there's perception management happening within the government. The government is actively understanding that it needs to manage the perception of the public, and they have programs like Project Blue Book to do that and everything like that. So really you have a couple of things happening in 1947 that are all linked together. You have the creation of the Air Force, you have the creation of the CIA, you have the creation of the mythology of this UFO, right? Because you have Kenneth Arnold, who's a pilot and sees these UFOs over Mount Rainier. And then you also have Roswell happening. Okay, so all of these events happened in 1947.
All within about, what, 9 months of each other?
Yeah, right? It's just unbelievable.
Like the whole, the whole national security apparatus is sort of comes into existence in the post-war era. And the whole flying saucer, UFO myth also sort of emerges at the same time. It's very, very interesting.
Yeah. So what I like, so all of this I thought would be a pretty, you know, oh, and then I did some study into the Russian and American space programs. And I found out that those are very strange. The roots of those are incredibly ritualistic. And even the very people that created our rocket technologies, like Jack Parsons on the American side and Konstantin Tchaikovsky on the Russian side, they had a belief system in which they believed that they were in touch with Tchaikovsky thought he was in touch with angels or angelic beings.
Right, like cosmic forces.
And there's a great book, by the way, if your listeners are interested, by Henry Jung called The Russian Cosmists.
Yeah, right. Interesting. The cosmos is a whole world. That's a whole tradition in Russian.
Yeah.
Right. It's like, that's interesting.
And so what I did was I basically referenced his title in American Cosmic. And I always make that known because he needs to be, you know, that book needs to be read. His book is amazing.
Oh, that's cool.
So what I was doing was I was identifying an American cosmic tradition, just like the Russian cosmists had their tradition. Well, we have our own tradition, and it that's is just cool. as that's weird, it. Right? I mean, it really is. In fact, it's more weird.
The Jack Parsons stuff, I think I can't remember it all, but it's just like, huh?
It is, is so bizarre. So yeah, it is so bizarre. But most people don't know this. Yeah. And so what I did was I was approached by people from our space program. And
interesting.
And at first I didn't really want to be involved with them because I thought I want to do my research at a distance, right? Because that's safe for me, right? But they continued on and were persistent. So I finally actually met Tyler in my book with Jeff Kripal. This is a scene in the book, and it's at a conference, an American Academy of Religion conference in Atlanta. And so I make Jeff go with me. I'm like, Jeff, this guy has clearances. I'm a little bit suspicious. He wants to tell me things about UFOs. You know, this is a setup and you need to like be there with me and be careful because he's charming. Right. And Jeff was like, yeah, sure. I'll do that. You know? So we go. He brings us to this great, like, I think it's the Ritz or something like this amazing hotel. And he pays for the whole thing. And he's like, just as I said, he charms us. I'm on guard. Jeff is disarmed. At the end, invites him to Houston, you know, wants him to meet his wife and kids and everything. I'm like, oh, great. So, so anyway, but this man believed that he was in touch with beings who were, he would call them extraterrestrial intelligences. And mm-hmm. so, but he didn't even know about Jack Parsons. Mm. He would go to JP Laboratory and he wouldn't mm-hmm. even know that that was a laboratory founded by Jack Parsons. He had no clue. Huh. So he was involved in this compartmentalization that happens within these communities. And they don't know what each other does, but he was at a really high level, involved with our space shuttle program all throughout its beginning and end, you know. Yeah, friends with Judy Resnick, you know, and the major astronauts. There were times when I would hang out with him and some astronauts and learn things that you could only learn by hanging out with them, because they're That's not going to cool. write That's it good. Down, I promise you.
I just got a chance, as a side note, but my wife, who writes book, helps people write books, is working on a collaborative book project with a former astronaut. So we just got a tour through NASA and in Houston, this one, and had a chance to do all the tour with her and went through all this
How
stuff.
How exciting.
It was fascinating. Yeah. So that's a whole world. It's really interesting.
It is. It's a subculture.
Yeah.
That most Americans are just not aware of.
Yeah.
So I wanted to shine a light into that subculture in my book. Mm. So I featured Tyler. I called him Tyler. And so things were really strange. So he invited me to go to New Mexico because he said that I didn't believe in UFOs, which was true, but that he had physical evidence, wanted to show me. Now, this is your classic kind of, I'm going to tell you something, you know. And so I knew it. And I said, well, can I have someone go with us? Because I just don't want to, you know, go alone. And plus we had to be blindfolded to go. So it was under this no fly zone and stuff. And so it was a secret place and where a UFO allegedly crashed.
What was it secret? You described the scene in the book. Was it secret military secret wise or just secret that he didn't want you to know where it was in
both?
Both. Okay.
Yeah. Well, you have to understand at that moment, I didn't believe him.
Yeah.
Right. I thought it was just weird. And but I wanted to know why he believed it.
Yeah.
And so I did ask Jeff Kripal to go with me, but Jeff said it was out of his comfort zone. He said, it's just too weird for me, Diana. I was like, yeah, it is weird. So I asked Gary Nolan, who I called at the time James in my book. And Gary Nolan was on it like that. He was like, yeah.
He's like, yeah, absolutely.
Yeah,
let's go.
Yeah. So we all went. So me, Tyler, Gary Nolan. We go to this place in New Mexico. Gary and I get blindfolded. We have to relinquish our phones, you know. Mm-hmm. And we do find these things. So out there, by the way, there was rubble. It was covered in rubble. So it took 45 mm-hmm. minutes or so to get to this place. And it was mm-hmm. in the desert of New Mexico. And we had to wear special clothes because it was going to be really hot but windy and rattlesnakes and, you know, things like that. So, and when I looked around, I saw just like rusted stuff everywhere. And I didn't understand what it was. And then Tyler told me that this was because these alleged crashes
yes.
happened, because I'm not going to say whether it's true or not. I do not know. Okay.
These were the sites of alleged crashes.
Yes.
And so there had been the idea that there might still be some debris there. So in order to sort of cover that up, they had sort of the powers that be had sort of spread
cans.
Metallic objects everywhere.
Basically,
so you couldn't
cans
tell the difference
everywhere.
Between. Yeah. Right.
And since it was in 1947, the cans had disintegrated and it was all rubbery stuff everywhere. I mean, literally everywhere, like as far as the eye can see. And it also looked like something that I'd seen before, but I wasn't sure. So in the first few paragraphs, I think, of the book, I describe where I'm looking up and I see something and I'm like, oh, that looks so familiar. And then Tyler says, do you recognize that? And I said,
I remember this.
I've not, you know, I've never been here before. How could I recognize it? And he said, it's the scene in the last series of The X-Files. And I was like,
they used that mesa.
Yes.
What's happening?
It was that mesa.
This is like the real and the virtual and the media.
Yeah,
the
exactly.
mediated. They're all combining. Yep. Here.
And that's, at first I was so confused. I was incredulous. I was like, what? Like, are you joking? But then it hit me that, of course, this is my book. This is exactly where reality and myth and fiction, you know, via computer, you know, via our screen culture. This is it. This is the new religion. This is ground zero of the new religion. Yeah. And I'm here. Yeah. And then I was in.
Well, so as you go through this, you go through a couple different phases in the book of trying to understand it. And I want to delve into some of those a little bit as we go through. And cause I, you know, I've done one interview on this podcast with Ross Coulthard, who's a journalist and is kind of talking about the, you know, more the nuts and bolts parts of it, you know, and then I come from this sort of, have this, you know, deep sort of spiritual and consciousness background. So I'm curious about that, and I want to talk about the way it interfaces with that in some way. But before we get to that, so since that time, since you were doing the, you know, the New York Times published their article.
Yes.
There's been an explosion of interest. Gary Nolan has become more public. People are talking about the different, you know, time travelers, dimensionality, all these different things. What is this non-human intelligence? Is there one? How was the government? No, the government sort of half kind of acknowledging that there's something going on, but they're a bit cagey about it. You know, it's like, we don't quite know. How has that process been for you? And so you sort of set yourself in the middle of this as you did this book. And what have you learned since the book's come out? What do you feel about everything that's happened over the last year?
Yeah. So it's not a normal book. All right. And it wasn't normal research. And I didn't know that when I'd gone into it. So it's completely shifted everything. It shifted my life. I look at my life as like pre-2012, post-2012. Right. Right. And so while my book was in press, this was in 2018, 2017, 2018. The New York Times, you know, releases these, you know, and then people have advanced copies of my book, some of who are in intelligence communities and some of who are people at the New York Times. And so I get barraged with phone calls and messages and everything. And they want to know who Tyler is. They want to know who James is. They want, they want to do it first. I have FBI people calling me. I mean, I'm freaked out. I'm like, oh my goodness. this is not.
Well, the word I heard, like we were at the conference, it was like, well, Diana's not, she's not coming. It's like, she's hiding out. It was kind of like, it was kind of that feeling like her book's about to come out and she like had to like, she had to go somewhere and just like, that was the feeling.
It was so like that. It was, I mean, I had never experienced anything like that, of course, you know? Yeah. So I did have Tyler, who's in that community, you know, intelligence community, help me through that part. Like basically say, this is what's going to happen. Everything he said came true. And in fact, everything he said, when we were out in New Mexico and we found these parts, Gary decided he was going to bring the parts through airport security. And Tyler said, this is what's going to happen. So in the car ride back, you know, he says, this is what's going to happen. There's going to be these lights. Gary stuff's going to be looked at. It's going to, you know, do this and that. And, you know, I just was waiting to see if it was going to happen. And indeed that happened. And so it was terrifying. Gary and I were terrified. Tyler was like, yeah, no problem. This is just how it goes. You know, he goes, those people who are, they don't know even what they're looking for, but there was just a signal. People in Washington are going to know exactly. And now Gary's on the list, right? Which he now knows he is. He got put on that list.
If he's not on the list by now.
Now he's on the list.
Whatever the list is, he should be on it.
So during that time period, between the time that my book was finished and in press and the time that the New York Times articles came out, I had to field a lot of good cop, bad cop stuff with people.
Yeah.
Like, you know, they talk to me in teams. And one would be extremely nice and flattering and this and that. And the other would be like, who's James? Who's Tyler? You know, this kind of thing. And I was like, I'm not going to say, you know, I just can't say. And I have academic freedom not to say. But it was also really scary because I thought, this is national security stuff. Maybe I'm supposed to say, you know, so I really didn't know.
Right.
So I had Tyler guided me through that. And he said, he actually wrote a list of stuff. He said, follow these guidelines and you'll be all right. Right. And when I accidentally would go off of those guidelines, I would get a phone call. You're off the guidelines, you know.
From him, yeah. You mean? Yeah.
And then there was a point where when the book did come out, Tyler and I could no longer speak to at all because his particular position was such that it wasn't a good idea for us to continue doing this research. And Gary now is an academic, so he and I could still collaborate, you know,
yeah,
that kind of thing. But sure. Gary's not from the same background that Tyler was from.
Yeah.
So I mean, I guess what happened was I inadvertently stepped into one of these government programs that Leslie Kane and Ralph Blumenthal talked about in their New York Times article.
Yeah,
and I was within it, you know, I was intimately hanging out with the people in the program, learning from them, but just thinking that they were fake, right? Thinking that this is all a setup or this is that, not even knowing that what was going to happen in the future.
Right.
But dutifully taking notes, you know, and you know, writing what I had observed. And I even had times with respect to the rubble, in the desert, my editor wanted me to take that out. She said, take it out. Why would you put that in there? And I said, because it was there, you know? And she said, but that doesn't make any sense. Why would all of a sudden in the middle of the desert, this rubble appear and be there? And I said, well, guess what? I don't know, but it's data points, right? So we have to keep it in there. And later, of course, we figured out why.
That's interesting. So it's a fascinating story. Were there aspects of the book that people particularly were interested in? Did you learn anything more about the book itself from the way in which people were interested in it?
Yeah. Strangely, I was barraged by correspondence from mathematicians and artists. And those are very, what I would call divergent communities, right? Like not similar. Was what I was thinking. Not so.
Yeah. Well, the high level, I think mathematicians and artists, they, you know, like at a certain level, they're not, but a higher level, I think there's more similarities.
And that's what I learned. I learned that absolutely. I met people who worked for these like aerospace and whatnot, who were both who was both an artist and a mathematician at a super high level. So I started to look into what was going on with the things, their practices, like what were they doing? And I came to the conclusion that they're working with dimensional objects, right? So, you know, there are dimensional objects like platonic solids, right?
And math is the way we've worked with those to the extent that we've worked with them. Mostly, right? Yeah.
And so I started to, the mathematicians who were talking to me actually would share with me what I should read or what I should watch, you know, which YouTube videos were good and which ones were not good, you know, about dimensions. And then the artists too were taught, you know, and so I learned a lot about if we do have interface with other entities or existences and we have communication with them, you know, is it an interdimensional communication that we're engaged in through either math or art? And that's the way that we communicate with them. And I think that's exactly what Constantine said. He said, we communicate with them. And he literally mentioned artists and mathematicians.
And it's fascinating that it happened like that.
It was so strange. After that, it was the protocols, Tyler's protocols, and also James, Gary Nolan also has these protocols. So what I noticed was that the people who were creating these technologies that were literally saving lives and helping people, they had certain ways of life that to me looked like monastic ways. Like, you know, a person who studies religion, I know a little bit about, you know, the people who practice these things. They would do intense either meditation or contemplative prayer. They would do physical protocols. They would make sure that they weren't a part of the media. Like they did not want any kind of, you know, media, like they just didn't want to have bad experiences with either people or the, or looking at things on the media that were disturbing. They wanted to keep their mental,
space, yeah, or yeah, they, somewhat mm-hmm. somewhat scrubbed yeah, of junk.
So they wanted to have this high level of existence that then yeah. they could, what they felt were download information that then could they could make into things.
Do you have a, has that inspired you to take up a particular meditation practice or contemplative yeah. prayer, or is that something you were doing before?
Well, I'd done it when I was a kid, right? So as a, you know, teenager and young person in my 20s.
In California, right?
Yeah, of course. So sure. I did experiment with a lot of that stuff yeah. and I now know why I did that. And so now looking back, I'm glad I had those experiences because they did catapult me into some pretty cool things, you know, like either artistic things, or I learned math really fast using those protocols. So fast forward to my life now, I have 5 children. And so I'm 5. Like, I have all, you know, these young kids at the time, you know, now they're teenagers, but back then they were young. And my life was crazy. I was doing this research. I was chairing my department and I also had these kids. So my life wasn't, you know, amenable to doing protocols.
No, there's no way you have time yeah. to do meditation.
So I did the best I could. So what I did was one of the things that Tyler suggested is giving up coffee, which that's yeah. crazy for me. I'm like, oh gosh, how can I do this? But I did it. So I gave up coffee. I ate as clean as possibly. I slept. Sleeping is a big thing. And especially if you have a lot of kids, you know, that's really hard to get. So I did the best I could to get the kind of sleep that he suggested one get, which, by the way, is a lot of sleep. And now I found out why. It puts your mind in, I think it's like a state of theta, which is, by the way, what we really need in order to produce incredible stuff. So I did do that. And it was amazing. It was life changing. And I haven't kept them up. Yeah. So every once in a while, I try to go back into doing them because I believe that they're really important for us to do.
Yeah. It reminds me a little bit of like some of the new age in the 80s where there was a certain emphasis on the austerity of it, you know, like,
yes.
That sort of in later in the 2000s and stuff, you saw that kind of faded from the scene a bit, but in the early days it was very much there. It's interesting. So I want to get deeper into the conscious stuff, but before I do, just this has been a decade of your life now.
Yes.
At the end of that decade, you know, we seem to, you know, obviously people come out and said all kinds of things about what they believe is true about these, what's happening, that we're being visited by some form of non-human intelligence or whatever, in some form or other, you know, people have different ways of pursuing that. Acknowledging that none of us have any kind of final or absolute or complete or anything like that knowledge of this phenomenon, that it transcends so many of our categories and distinctions and abilities to capture it in any kind of coherent way. What do you feel like, especially since your book's come out, you've learned about this phenomenon or about its reality? So one of the ways I like to put it is like, what do you think you know about?
Yeah, good.
Acknowledging that we don't.
Yeah, what do we think we know?
Like, I have things I think I know about it. But I know, but
you don't know if you do. Yeah, exactly. Okay, that's a great way to put it. I'm going to use that, by the way. that's a hard question, too. But this is what I think I know about it now. Okay. I think I know that, okay, and this is a far cry from where I begin, right? I begin as an atheist with respect to UFOs and knowledge of this stuff. I then go through these processes, you know, of coming to terms with believing in some way. So then I have to articulate what is it that I believe and how do I believe? And then also I have to separate my professional writing and publication of stuff that I can source and prove, and then stuff that I just can't. Okay. And so on podcasts, I always like to remind people listening, this isn't peer reviewed, right? Yeah. This is just like, I'm going to speculate. None of it is going to be something that I can prove. Okay. But if I'm writing an article, it's going to be sourced and it's going to be peer reviewed and things like that.
Understood.
Okay.
All right.
So this is what I think I know. And this falls in the category of speculation, of course. It appears to me that there are these, that there are things that we've been in contact with as humans, and that the historical record shows that, right? So, you know, and then when you see the patterns today and the patterns yesteryear or whatnot, they look so suspiciously
similar.
Yeah. And that we can't say, you know, we don't know what it is, but we can certainly say something's going on. All right. Talking to people that are high level scientists and researchers, either in our space program or at some of our universities who are engaged in this study in different types of ways, it appears that the human body is some type of a receiver of information and maybe even a transmitter. And that these protocols help us if we can get to a point where we can tune ourselves to hooking into this network, that we can get information and we can also create things that are helpful for us, whether pleasingly helpful or significantly helpful for people, right? In terms of like biotechnologies and things like that. So I do believe in these things. I do not believe in them as they're portrayed in entertainment media, you know? So I don't believe that they're these little green men type things, although people have seen little men and stuff like that, or little beings, I guess you could call them.
Grays.
Grays. I do believe, I mean, there could be those, and they might, you know, this is maybe how they manifest. But I also believe, I guess I'm more inclined in the direction of the Konstantin Tchaikovsky belief that mathematicians and artists have use the techniques of deciphering the symbolic language, and that this symbolic language is here for us. And I think a lot of it even is story. Like a lot of times we get information from stories, and that information could also be visitor information, you know? So I tend to think back, the best way I can describe how I believe is going back to the reference of the muses, the Greek muses.
Yeah.
As actual literature.
There's a lot about creativity in your book, and that's a very interesting subject in and of itself, right? Where does it come from? And in that context, we sort of see creativity as sort of emerging from a foreign place outside of us. And I always find this an interesting question because I don't know if that's true or not, but the experience of creativity so feels like that often that, and I know this in my own experience, that sometimes that's often how it's been referenced in history. And that's what the muses is, right? That sense of,
external, we give external agency to something that we might be doing ourselves. But that's just how the brain works with creativity because the cognitive scientists whose work I read on creativity basically said that there's, I guess, our frontal lobe or cortex or executive decision-making part of our brain gets shut down during
it has to move aside.
And that's when people then say, another like a being was telling me this.
Exactly.
And it could be anything.
I had this.
You know?
It seems, I think the experience of it not coming out of directly out of the a conclusion of the executive function of our frontal cortex is almost the experience of it bypassing. It bypasses it and comes from something else.
And that's the language we use.
Right, exactly.
It's interesting. Because that's how we feel it. It's not like our normal everyday reality. So I think that this is really interesting, what's happening with creativity right now. You know, science of creativity is fascinating, you know?
Yeah, certainly.
And definitely interfaces here with the study of people who study UFOs.
Yeah. And what did you feel like you think you know about, you were involved in some government agencies, you were connected to them. There's a big question now. Well, I'll ask you two questions. The big question now is, what does our government know, and will we find it out? I guess I would ask, like, what do you think you know about that and about those two questions? And then the other question is, there seems to be a sort of a disagreement. This phenomenon seems to be historical, as you say.
Yeah.
And it seems like some people have a sense that it is historical all throughout human history, but it's sped up, but there's more now. It's sped up in the 20th century. And then some people say, no, it's just the same as it's always been. And do you have thoughts about both those?
Yeah, I think that it's the same as it's always been. And I think that now we just have technologies that we can take videos or whatnot and upload them to social media sites. And now people can see them in real simultaneous time instead of, you know, so it's so it seems as if it's sped up only because our sense of time is different.
We're sharing them and people are hearing about it.
Exactly. Yeah.
That's interesting. Right.
In terms of the government and what I learned or what I think I know or what I think I learned. So just as I was approached by Tyler in the beginning of my research, I was approached by other people and groups of people after my book came out. And I learned that this made me very depressed, to tell you the truth, what I learned. Because, you know, the information is absolutely managed. And not just that information. I just learned that it seemed like the whole, our whole infrastructure is completely, like I lived in a naive state for a very long period of time. I did. I was a naive person. And this experience of meeting these people and these communities of people who are tasked with managing what we know about certain things, even political things, depressed me because I realized those bad conspiracy theories look to be true, you know? And I'm like, it's like, man, now what am I, is it going to be Bigfoot next? You know what I mean? Like,
what's next?
So it was really horrifying and depressing. And I guess at that point, that's when I started to become obsessed with reading Plato's Republic again. And you know, because there's that allegory of the cave, you know? And so I was obsessed with that for like a year and a half, and I wanted to know who those people were who were tying up the, you know, us and showing and flickering, you know, doing the flickers on the cave wall. Because I felt like I met them. I met them, you know, they're real. And I thought this isn't actually a metaphor. So I talked to a lot of people who thought I was crazy and said, no, it's just a metaphor. He's just saying that. And I said, no, it's not.
And damn it.
And so I started to reach out to philosophers of Socratic tradition, right? And now so I'm writing the next book, and a lot of it is going to be framed by Plato's Republic because, I mean, he basically called it back then. He said, there's no place for the philosopher in the political realm. You know, there's no place. I mean, there's no place for justice. You know, we can say there is, but that's...
But it's funny. I have a whole nonprofit that's trying to merge politics and philosophy. It's one of my projects. And so that's interesting. I appreciate the challenge, believe me.
Yes, that's like, it's so, I mean, it's almost impossible. So I'm at the point where I think it's probably impossible, but that doesn't mean that we should give up.
We shouldn't try, right?
Exactly. Yeah. So, you know, one of the things that Plato ends with is this dialectic and says, you know, what kind of craft, you know, Socrates is talking to Glaucon and he's basically saying, how do we deal with the fact that we live in this constructed reality, right? That's constructed, other people are constructing it. Yeah. How do we deal with this? And so the dialectic was the answer, this kind of it was basically a mystical form of engagement with others. And so that's what I'm doing now. That's what my project is now, is to kind of look at that with respect to this UFO thing.
Interesting. I'd be very curious to see how that unfolds. So one of the frames in your book, which I found interesting, and you know, and it was this sort of idea of the sort of, you know, if I can use the term, naive modernism view of the phenomenon, which is, you know, in the lingo, sort of the nuts and bolts, you know, it's craft from outer space, you know.
Yeah.
And when scientific skeptics, you know, the Neil deGrasse Tysons of the world or the Steven Pinkers of the world, you know, when they criticize it, they're often criticizing that version of it. You know, it's like, but I think as you get deeper into it, and I think, you know, we probably have Jacques Vallée to thank for this, because I think, and John Keel to some extent, I think probably were the two researchers who initially sort of, you know, took hold of this thing and tried to like make sense of it. And in trying to make sense of it, they sort of said, this thing, it cannot be held in that category. It, you know, it can't, it's more than that. It's strange. It's weird. There's weird synchronicities. There's a trickster element to it. There's something, whatever is going on here. And we don't even know if it's one thing or many things.
Right.
This is, you know, but these things, they transcend our categories. Also, there's all kinds of, they seem to interact with consciousness in ways that are unpredictable and strange. And I find sometimes, because that's sort of my background, I have this kind of background of, you know, 20 years of spiritual practice and delving into consciousness and researching those areas. And I sometimes feel when I'm reading people talk, especially when I'm reading like scientists talk about consciousness, I'm thinking, God, there needs to be more interaction here, because sometimes I just feel they're not very, you know, they need to catch up.
Yeah, a little bit. But they think they know.
Exactly. With the world. I mean, this is, and with a history of also religious thought,
yeah,
and conscience, there's so much, yeah, there, you know?
Yeah.
And even though that was in a different frame, mm-hmm, there's a lot of awareness there. And so, you know, saying multiple things here, but I thought one of the interesting things was you talked about like the, and then there's a kind of the post, you talk about sort of a postmodern frame, looking at historical context, looking at the interpretive structure of all this, looking at the sociological elements of all this. And not just approaching it as a naive sort of realist in a way, I guess I can use that term. And then Jacques Vallée kind of comes and says, hey, don't discount the ontological status. It's like this move where we can't also just say, okay, this isn't real. And it's not real in any kind of just conventional, straightforward sense, but we also can't discount it and sort of get away from it and just say, oh, it's narratives and this whole way we interpret our experience, mm-hmm, and that there's not something, there's also a phenomenon going on here that's also profound and interesting and real. And so we kind of have to make the effort to understand it and try to reach our arms around it, even though we know we can't in any conventional sense, that we're going to have to include frames of reference and frames of understanding that we're barely even beginning to really approach as a species, as humans, that include consciousness, that include the interpretive structures, the way our brain works, that includes all these other aspects of reality, creativity, and the way you talk about, that aren't easily contained in the kind of nuts and bolts. And so we kind of have to lean into this and try to understand it as a real phenomenon while knowing it's sort of outside our grasp at the same time. Anyway, I just wanted to kind of put that out and see what your thoughts are.
Yeah, that's absolutely the case. Because there was a point in the book where I, you know, I describe this conference where I'm with Jacques Vallée, and here I am in kind of not a very sophisticated, you know, I'm trying to understand it, and I'm using the complete, it's all subjective type of framework.
Yeah.
And
right,
so
exactly.
Then, you know,
it's like the, okay, it's not totally objective in a modernist sense, yeah, but neither is it totally subjective,
right,
in postmodern sense. We have to transcend and include, not transcend and exclude.
Right? That's right. And that's when Jacques comes down and basically, you know, reprimands me and, you know,
yeah,
and basically says, with, you know, with the statement of you can't ignore the ontology, the ontological aspects.
Yeah.
And of course, everybody looks at me like, idiot, you know, and I'm like, oh, gosh. Okay. So, you know, that's where, so one of the good things that happened from publishing the book was that I've met so many incredible scientists and computer scientists and people in the, you know, developing technology. A lot of what they're doing is interfaces with your brain and like understanding the frequencies of certain sounds and technologies and things like that, mm-hmm, and how it creates brain states, right? And how during those brain states, we actually get information or absorb information. And so this actually does get to the UFO thing, because during the UFO event, people experience reality in ways in which these scientists can kind of like almost like replicate it by, you know, manipulating your brain and your, you know, your body and things like this. And even through technology. And so, you know, we're coming up with a lot with a better framework for understanding at least when a person experiences these things, what's happening in them physiologically and cognitively.
Right, right.
And we can then say, okay, when do other states, like creative states, artistic states, do they replicate this? Like, you know, when a Buddhist monk is meditating, is their brain state like this person's state, you know? So we can do this comparative analysis. And I think that this is where we're going to be able to adjudicate what is, you know, adjudicate this apparent dualism of the nuts and bolts UFO compared to the consciousness aspect of it. I think they're not, I mean, we, you know, they're not diametrically opposed.
No, not at all. Right. But one can't be reduced to the other.
No, they can't be. They have to be understood together. Yeah. So there's some exciting research being done right now. These people, though, they're kind of like what Tyler and James were like in the beginning. They don't want to be known, because once you become known, you can't do anything without like a group of, you know, a bunch of group of people.
Oh, I'm
basically
sure.
Like,
I can understand.
Yeah.
I mean, I look at Gary, I'm sure Gary, you know, I think it's courageous what he's done, which is to, and so I totally appreciate it. And I think more people need to do it. And I think it will help. Nevertheless, at a personal level, I can see why the life he lives now is probably not as sane as the life he lived
crazy.
4 years ago.
Yeah. Yeah. And you know, the other people that are doing the work, they look at that and they're like, I don't want that in my life because you know, they're interested more in the work than in any kind of, not that Gary isn't. I mean, Gary's just at the top, right? Of he has nothing to lose, really, because he's won everything, right?
Well, he's already done everything.
Yeah, he has.
He's won everything except the Nobel Prize.
Yeah, exactly. You know,
So, let me delve into this a little more. And in like the framework I use to think about reality, in some sense, I use the kind of this sort of objective, subjective, and then intersubjective lens. So the objective world, the interior subjective world, and then the intersubjective world, meaning the interior of the collective, right? The collective psyche in some sense. And that's the world we often don't think about when we think about, when people think about reality, that some people don't even believe that exists, right?
Right.
But I think it ontologically is real. And, you know, and that's a world that contains, and we all tap into that and exist within that. And it contains forces and archetypes and arguably beings and things that at least present as beings that we can tap into or channel or experience. And it's the world of dreams and maybe even precognitions. And it's a world that in which we participate in the sort of collective experience of at least humanity and maybe beyond in some level. Psychically, psychologically, in our consciousness, right?
Yeah.
So at least that's a presupposition of mine, and so I always find it interesting because if you go back in the spiritual history, you know, people are always encountering beings, and you know, kind of it's just part of that world.
Yes.
So especially in the New Age and stuff, when you get now sometimes in certain religious traditions, they sort of encourage you. To in my own tradition, a little bit like this. This will encourage you to be a little cautious of those realities, you know, like, and you know, all the kind of wild esoteric stuff. And I was always personally very interested in it, even though my own spiritual path was sort of like, you know, kind of de-emphasized that a bit. And that's not uncommon. But I was always very curious about it anyway, about those things. And there's all these esoteric realities. How real they are is open for debate. And sometimes I think when people talk about the interdimensionality or dimensionality of these intelligences, they can almost go to the other side where you have, well, you have like one group that dismisses all those things as being just unreal, right? And then you can go the other side where you almost give, you can give too much ontological reality to all of those forces and things that exist within that inner subjective domain. Meaning that there's a great line by an Aurobindian scholar. He said, you know, he said, every being is a force, every force is a being. Meaning that you can experience, it's like the instincts in Greek. You know, you can experience your instincts as sort of intelligent forces acting upon you. And maybe in dreams, you might experience them as a as an intelligent being that's pushing you, and as a motive intelligence that's pushing you in a certain direction. You experience it as a being, you know, you in a deep state of meditation or an in your death experience. You might experience all kinds of forces as intelligent motive intelligences pushing you in a certain direction. And that's one way to think about it. You know, if you did ayahuasca, you might experience nature forces as beings that represent themselves to you as almost intelligent,
yes.
You know, as yeah. intelligent yeah. in some way. And in some sense, I suppose they are. Mm-hmm. I want to be able to acknowledge that those are all in some ways, some form of intelligences, some form of things with motives and intensive and you know, archetypal energies and all this stuff. While also acknowledging that if we're talking about what we're talking about when we talk about the phenomenon, there's a level of ontological reality, and I would say depth of ontological reality that exists in the physical world as well. That's outside of what we normally consider in that interior world. It may interface with it in some way, but it's not. We can't conflate it all. So anyway, I'm not explaining this very clearly, but I feel we have to get beyond just, on one hand, dismissing it all as unreal, or just conflating it all in the same ontological way. It's all non-human intelligence. It's all the same ontological status. Whereas this phenomenon seems to be its own particular ontological status in the sense that it may be more evolved than us in some way. So anyway, just your thoughts about
that. Yeah, I totally understand what you're saying. I think that's an excellent point. And so, okay, let's take this example of meeting these forces of, you know, when say people are taking ayahuasca and they're in this state where they're meeting natural forces like the plant being or whatever.
Davids.
Yeah, exactly. You
know, plant Davids or something.
And
right?
these present exactly. to them. So what I think is that I give objective status, ontological status to these forces. Mm-hmm. How we perceive them is basically a Kantian thing. You know, we're basically mm-hmm. perceiving them through the only way that we can perceive things, right? Because we mm-hmm. have perceptual apparati, you know, that perceive mm-hmm. things in certain ways, and we've been taught.
Yeah, right.
So, you know, of course we're going to ascribe some kind of being status to it because
exactly.
Right. But that doesn't take away from its own ontological reality.
Its own reality its own energy level,
right.
whatever it is.
Now we access that through ayahuasca. That's the protocol. Mm-hmm. That's the thing that opens that space in our brain to get to that dimension, right? Now that dimension that is opened up through like LSD, ayahuasca, whatever, entheogens and things like that, peyote. That dimension has its own rules that we just don't know. It has its own space-time. You know, it has its own physics. Yeah. We just don't know those rules. And that's where I think we're actually making some progress. It's because I think what we're doing, especially with mathematics and computer science and these, like, you know, like the Platonic solids, like objects in other dimensions, we're actually able now to map them out. And that's much different than we've ever done, right? So, you know, you take peyote, we're not mapping those out really, those kinds of...
No,
but
you're experiencing subjectively, but we haven't been able to like try to more objectively sort of understand the sort of the physics of that world.
And I think with the UFO, and I think the UFO does have a different way of being here with us than mm-hmm. what we experience, say, when we take peyote, because you can see them on radar.
Yeah.
I mean, they're physically.
And that to me, that speaks to their ontological status as something more akin to us than maybe akin to a plant, David.
Right.
Or something, you know, maybe something beyond us, but something more akin to us.
Yes. Know? Yes. And
but may interface with those worlds in ways that we don't in the same way.
Exactly. So, you know, I mean, the kind of stuff that Gary is doing is he's looking at the material debris. And he's doing, you know, microscopic work on this and understanding it. And, you know, it's fascinating to hear him talk about that work because it's like the object itself exists in different realities.
That's interesting. And that's fascinating.
You know, maybe that's going to give us a clue.
Yeah. Or maybe material objects are interfacing in some way with energies that sort of cross barriers that
cross dimensions, right?
Yeah, that we don't naturally, that we don't cross in a sense, or we, maybe our brain does in some sense that we don't understand,
right?
But that we don't aren't used to. That's fascinating. When you look at UFOs and you start reading about the abduction phenomenon and all that, it's its own weird and strange world. And there's so much, it's so hard to sort through. And I know at a certain point, like when I was looking at all this in the 2000s, at a certain point, I just thought, I don't really know how to make sense of this.
I know.
I get people are experiencing things and it seems like a lot of different things are happening, you know, but, and some seem more real, and not because I was the editor of a spiritual magazine. I used to get books all the time.
That's right. That's right. Yeah.
Like, you know, and letters and thing. And I experienced this and that. And I just like sorting through these, you know, and like some seem very interesting, powerful experiences. Some didn't seem that interesting. And then the other thing that was, you start to see, oh, people are having spiritual awakenings. They're using this interpretive frame to self as a form of spiritual self-actualization. If that makes sense, that's their spiritual awakening is through this frame. It's not like someone having this experience in 1920,
right?
Or 1820. They're aware of this frame. This is a frame through which they're like, I could take that frame and I could almost change it to a completely different frame, and it would still be a spiritual awakening. Mm-hmm. You know, it's like, but they're using this frame, which is interesting. I thought your book kind of spoke to that, the way in which, and to me, it's very hard to sort out like what's true about the phenomenon in relationship to this experience.
Oh, I see what you're saying.
Versus they're having a great spiritual awakening or an awakening to, you know, from an integral, if you're familiar with integral philosophy, but what it called to postmodern values. Mm-hmm. You know, at one point in your book, someone mentions these are all the values of our regular life, and these are all the values of the phenomenon. Well, I could just as easily say these are all the values of modernism, and these are all the values of postmodernism.
Yeah. You know,
and it's like, and so people have these postmodern awakenings, have spiritual awakenings, and it's interpreted through this lens. And there's nothing wrong with that. That's okay. That's fine. That's a contemporary lens, but it's very hard to sort through what's real about the phenomenon in that, if that on its own, you know, and that's interesting. I thought, yeah, does that make sense?
It does. So how I deal with that problem, challenge, whatever, you know, cause it's a challenge, right? Is that in comparative analysis. So I have in one of the chapters of American Cosmic, I feature Ray Hernandez and Dolce Hernandez, their husband and wife. Mm. And they have an experience. He's an atheist. And she's Catholic. And they have an experience of this thing that she calls an angel, comes down and it heals their dog. Okay. And then they have multiple
Oh, I think I remember this.
Yeah, they have multiple UFO experiences and stuff. And so, you know, he thinks that this is an extraterrestrial entity, right?
Right. Yeah.
And
she thinks it's a religious
entity. Yeah, she's convinced it's an angel.
Right.
And so they have different ways of describing this, but what happens is the same. You know what I'm saying? So if you take, so the same thing with Teresa of Avila and then people in John Mack's abduction book, right? So hers happened hundreds of years ago. In this paper that I wrote, basically I want to ask this question, how do we responsibly compare transhistorical phenomena that we can't say they're the same phenomena, even though they appear to look like the same phenomena. You know, we just don't have that knowledge, right? So we just compare it and we basically take out those parts that are structurally similar. And I think that's what we can do. And there are lots of things that once you start doing that, that you didn't even notice before.
Yeah, right. I believe it. That's interesting.
You know, I mean, one thing that I didn't even notice before was that every time somebody had one of these events, it was changed by the media, whatever media was functioning at that time.
It sort of shaped.
Yes.
It's just like, ooh.
Yeah. The weird parts were like, you know.
Yeah, right. It's like Kenneth Arnold, who knew he saw orbs.
Yeah, you know, exactly.
Like, that was just not part of the history,
right? Exactly. So that's something that's always there.
Yeah.
You know, and it's something that most people would never, because they're focused
and even more so in the religion, in the religious context, I mean, who knows how many of the stories we hear through religious context were shaped in various ways. It's fascinating.
Well, that's my job. I'm supposed to figure it out. I'm supposed to. So I did. So I went back and I looked at Teresa and I saw that a lot of her people redacted her story, like editors, Catholic editors and stuff. And they took out certain things like her reference to this thing as a real being. Instead of an imagined
interesting.
Being.
Wow. Like
they're
that's
like,
fascinating.
Nah, that can't be a real being.
So I've been through a few different phases with this. You know, I got interested in this in the 80s and, you know, I just always sort of tried to maintain some interest and had some interest in the 90s and 2000s and then sort of lost track of it for a while. But I dip into it just to try then because I knew it was like, I've always known there's something important here and interesting. It's just, I was sort of limited in how far I could go with
right.
it. The nice thing about the last few years, you do feel through this kind of, through so many people becoming interested in it, there's a different kind of attention on it, mm-hmm. a different kind of scholarly. And so I do feel like there's the opportunity for progress on this. And you know, it may be that the government also has some knowledge of this thing that we may learn over the years, and that may help as well, even though I don't think anyone knows all the answers or anything like that. It feels different than any point in my life where there have been moments where it felt like something might happen and unfold, but it feels like now there's a different kind of awareness to people are more willing to speak about it. Scholars are more willing to speak publicly about it, to collaborate on it, to investigate it. There's just a lot of, it's just a very different era that we're in. At the same time, there's no acknowledgement from a certain level of sort of mainstream culture yet, mm-hmm. beyond just like New York Times did a wild article. I don't know what it means. Now, I don't know what it will take to get over that hump, but that it feels like when we get over that hump, that's going to be another sort of phase shift probably in how we understand this phenomenon. I don't know what that will mean. You know, there was this interview with Lou Elizondo, who was the person who ran some of this programs for the ATIP for the Defense Department. Now, I don't know how much he knows, but someone asked him, how do you think we would relate to this if everything you know was known by everyone? And he talks about the kind of a sober moment. That was his description. Like we'd have a very sober moment about our place and our species. And I don't know what that means exactly. It's like you can be sober for all kinds of reasons. Do you have a reading on how a kind of new awareness of what you know, what is known would hit our species? What's your reading on how that would hit us? Would it hit us in a dystopian way? Would we be excited? Would we be sober? Yeah. Would we be?
Right. So I just gave a talk. Actually, it was a class. It was a 4-session class on UFOs and UAPs, right? And I had a lot of very interesting people in the class. And one of them kind of asked me something similar. And I used the word somber. And then they said that's what the term that Lou had used. I didn't know that he had said this, but so did he use sober or somber?
Maybe he used somber. I can't remember. I thought it was sober, but it may have been somber. Maybe I can't remember. Yeah.
And the strange thing is that, you know, let's put it this way. I am always skeptical of people that say, I can't tell you everything. But in a sense, I'm kind of like that too. But, you know, I can tell you what I can tell you, right? I don't have a clearance.
I know, isn't that horrible?
Yeah.
You hate that. Yeah. You have to do it.
but I agree. I think that the things that I learned brought me to a place of being, I describe it as somber. I have a somber outlook.
Interesting. Well, I may leave it at that, unless you have anything else you'd like to add. That's a good ending. I appreciate it. It's fun to explore it. And I appreciate, like, I think because you come at this from a religious sensibility and your history of sort of research on those issues, I feel like we can kind of dive into some subjects that with so many people, it's sort of harder to dive into without a long preparation. So I appreciate it.
Oh yeah, absolutely. Yeah. Thank you so much. It was a great conversation.
Yeah. All right. Well, thank you.
Okay. Yeah. Have a great evening.
I want to thank Diana Pasulka for joining me today on the podcast. It's a fascinating subject. It was a fascinating discussion. And if you want to follow up a little more on her work, the book, once again, is called American Cosmic. And it's a great read, and I certainly recommend it. All right. That's it for today's episode. One final mention that you can always follow this podcast more closely, and you can get the latest news and information about it by signing up for my newsletter, which is also called Thinking Ahead. And you can sign up for that at carterphipps.com/thinkingahead. Thanks for joining me today, and I look forward to next time. Thank you.